Chapter 17. Footstep in the path ahead of him, and, turning the corner of the bushes, confronted the footpost on his way to Welland. In answer to St. Cleve's inquiry, if there was anything for himself, the postman handed out one letter, and proceeded on his route. Swithin opened and read the letter as he walked, till it brought him to a standstill by the importance of its contents. They were enough to agitate a more phlegmatic youth than he. He leant over the wicket which came in his path, and endeavored to comprehend the sense of the whole. The large long envelope contained, first, a letter from a solicitor in a northern town, informing him that his paternal great-uncle, who had recently returned from the Cape whither he had gone in an attempt to repair a broken constitution, was now dead and buried. This great-uncle's name was like a new creation to Swithin. He had held no communication with the young man's branch of the family for innumerable years, never, in fact, since the marriage of Swithin's father with the simple daughter of Welland Farm. He had been a bachelor to the end of his life, and had amassed a fairly good professional fortune by a long and extensive medical practice in the smoky, dreary, manufacturing town in which he had lived and died. Swithin had always been taught to think of him as the embodiment of all that was unpleasant in man. He was narrow, sarcastic, and shrewd to unseemliness. That very shrewdness had enabled him, without much professional profundity, to establish his large and lucrative connection, which lay almost entirely among a class who neither looked nor cared for drawing-room courtesies. However, what Dr. St. Cleve had been as a practitioner matters little. He was now dead, and the bulk of his property had been left to persons with whom this story has nothing to do. But Swithin was informed that out of it there was a bequest of £600 a year to himself, payment of which was to begin with his 21st year, and continue for his life, unless he should marry, before reaching the age of 25. In the latter precocious and objectionable event his annuity would be forfeited. The accompanying letter, said the solicitor, would explain all. This, the second letter, was from his uncle to himself, written about a month before the former's death, and deposited with his will, to be forwarded to his nephew, when that event should have taken place. Swithin read, with the solemnity that such posthumous epistles inspire, the following words from one who, during life, had never once addressed him. Dear nephew, you will doubtless experience some astonishment at receiving a communication from one whom you have never personally known, and who, when this comes into your hands, will be beyond the reach of your knowledge. Perhaps I am the loser by this lifelong mutual ignorance. Perhaps I am much to blame for it, perhaps not. But such reflections are profitless at this date. I have written with quite other views than to work up a sentimental regret on such an amazingly remote hypothesis as that the fact of a particular pair of people not meeting, among the millions of other pairs of people who have never met, is a great calamity either to the world in general or to themselves. The occasion of my addressing you is briefly this. 9 months ago a report casually reached me that your scientific studies were pursued by you with great ability, and that you were a young man of some promise as an astronomer. My own scientific proclivities rendered the report more interesting than it might otherwise have been to me, and it came upon me quite as a surprise that an issue of your father's merit should have so much in him, or you might have seen more of me in former years than you are ever likely to do now. My health had then begun to fail, and I was starting for the Cape, or I should have come myself to inquire into your condition and prospects. I did not return till 6 months later, and as my health had not improved I sent a trusty friend to examine into your life, pursuits, and circumstances, without your own knowledge, and to report his observations to me. This he did. Through him I learned of favorable news. (1) That you worked assiduously at the science of astronomy. (2) That everything was auspicious in the career you had chosen. Of unfavorable news. apostrophe 1, that the small income at your command, even when eked out by the sum to which you would be entitled on your grandmother's death, and the freehold of the homestead, would be inadequate to support you becomingly as a scientific man, whose lines of work were of a nature not calculated to produce emoluments for many years, if ever. Apostrophe 2, that there was something in your path worse than narrow means, and that that something was a woman. To save you, if possible, from ruin on these heads, I take the preventive measures detailed below. The chief step is, as my solicitor will have informed you, that, at the age of 25, the sum of £600 a year be settled on you for life, provided you have not married, before reaching that age, a yearly gift of an equal sum to be also provisionally made to you in the interim, and, vice versa, that if you do marry, before reaching the age of 25 you will receive nothing from the date of the marriage. One object of my bequest is that you may have resources sufficient to enable you to travel and study the southern constellations. When at the Cape, after hearing of your pursuits, I was much struck with the importance of those constellations to an astronomer just pushing into notice. There is more to be made of the southern hemisphere than ever has been made of it yet. The mine is not so thoroughly worked as the northern, and thither your studies should tend. The only other preventive step in my power is that of exhortation, at which I am not an adept. Nevertheless, I say to you, Swith and St. Cleeve, don't make a fool of yourself, as your father did. If your studies are to be worth anything, believe me, they must be carried on without the help of a woman. Avoid her, and every one of the sex, if you mean to achieve any worthy thing. Eschew all of that sort for many a year yet. Moreover, I say, the lady of your acquaintance avoid in particular. I have heard nothing against her moral character hitherto. I have no doubt it has been excellent. She may have many good qualities, both of heart and of mind. But as he has, in addition to her original disqualification as a companion for you, that is, that of sex, these two serious drawbacks. She is much older than yourself, apostrophe, much older. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Swithin resentfully. Apostrophe, and she is so impoverished that the title she derives from her late husband is a positive objection. Beyond this, frankly, I don't think well of her. I don't think well of any woman who dotes upon a man younger than herself. To care to be the first fancy of a young fellow like you shows no great common sense in her. If she were worth her salt, she would have too much pride to be intimate with a youth in your unassured position, to say no worse. She is old enough to know that a liaison with her may, and almost certainly would, be a ruin, and, on the other hand, that a marriage would be preposterous, unless she is a complete goose, and in that case there is even more reason for avoiding her than if she were in her few senses. A woman of honorable feeling, nephew, would be careful to do nothing to hinder you in your career, as this putting of herself in your way most certainly will. Yet I hear that she professes a great anxiety on this same future of yours as a physicist. The best way in which she can show the reality of her anxiety is by leaving you to yourself. Perhaps she persuades herself that she is doing you no harm. Well, let her have the benefit of the possible belief, but depend upon it that in truth she gives the lie to her conscience by maintaining such a transparent fallacy. Women's brains are not formed for assisting at any profound science. They lack the power to see things except in the concrete. She'll blab your most secret plans and theories to every one of her acquaintance, apostrophe, she's got none. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Swithin, beginning to get warm. Apostrophe, and make them appear ridiculous by announcing them before they are matured. If you attempt to study with a woman, you'll be ruled by her to entertain fancies instead of theories, air castles instead of intentions, qualms instead of opinions, sickly prepossessions instead of reasoned conclusions. Your wide heaven of study, young man, will soon reduce itself to the miserable narrow expanse of her face, and your myriad of stars to her two trumpery eyes. A woman waking a young man's passions just at a moment when he is endeavoring to shine intellectually is doing little less than committing a crime. Like a certain philosopher, I would, upon my soul, have all young men from 18 to 25 kept under barrels, seeing how often, in the lack of some such sequestering process, the woman sits down before each as his destiny, and too frequently enervates his purpose, till he abandons the most promising course ever conceived. But no more. I now leave your fate in your own hands. Your well-wishing relative, Jocelyn Street Cleave, doctor in medicine. ... As coming from a bachelor and hardened misogynist of 72, the opinions herein contained were nothing remarkable. But their practical result in restricting the sudden endowment of Swithin's researches by conditions which turned the favor into a harassment was, at this unique moment, discomfiting and distracting in the highest degree. Sensational, however, as the letter was, the passionate intention of the day was not hazarded for more than a few minutes thereby. The truth was, the caution and bribe came too late, too unexpectedly, to be of influence. They were the sort of thing which required fermentation to render them effective. Had St. Cleave received the exhortation a month earlier, had he been able to run over in his mind, at every wakeful hour of 30 consecutive nights, a private catechism on the possibilities opened up by this annuity, there is no telling what might have been the stress of such a web of perplexity upon him, a young man whose love for celestial physics was second to none. But to have held before him, at the last moment, the picture of a future advantage that he had never once thought of, or discounted for present staying power, it affected him about as much as the view of horizons shown by sheet lightning. He saw an immense prospect. It went, and the world was as before. He caught the train at Warburn, and moved rapidly towards Bath. Not precisely in the same key as when he had dressed in the hut at dawn, but, as regarded the mechanical part of the journey, as unhesitatingly as before. And with the change of scene even his gloom left him, his bosom's lord sat lightly in his throne. St. Cleave was not sufficiently in mind of poetical literature to remember that wise poets are accustomed to read that lightness of bosom inversely. Swithin thought it an omen of good fortune. And as thinking is causing in not a few such cases, he was perhaps, in spite of poets, right. 6. At the station Lady Constantine appeared, standing expectant. He saw her face from the window of the carriage long before she saw him. He no sooner saw her than he was satisfied to his heart's content with his prize. If his great-uncle had offered him from the grave a kingdom instead of her, he would not have accepted it. Swithin jumped out, and nature never painted in a woman's face more devotion than appeared in my lady's at that moment. To both the situation seemed like a beautiful allegory, not to be examined too closely, lest its defects of correspondence with real life should be apparent. They almost feared to shake hands in public, so much depended upon their passing, that morning without molestation. A fly was called, and they drove away. "Take this," she said, handing him a folded paper. "It belongs to you, rather than to me." At crossings, and other occasional pauses, pedestrians turned their faces and looked at the pair for no reason but that, among so many, there were naturally a few of the sort who have eyes to note what incidents come in their way as they plod on, but the two in the vehicle could not but fear that these innocent beholders had special detective designs on them. "You look so dreadfully young," she said with humorous fretfulness, as they drove along, Swithin's cheeks being amazingly fresh from the morning air. "Do try to appear a little haggard, that the parson mayn't ask us awkward questions." Nothing further happened, and they were set down opposite a shop about 50 yards from the church door, at 11:05. "We will dismiss the fly," she said. "It will only attract idlers." On turning the corner and reaching the church, they found the door ajar. but the building contained only two persons, a man and a woman, the clerk and his wife. As they learned, Swithin asked when the clergyman would arrive. The clerk looked at his watch, and said, at just on 11 o'clock. He ought to be here, said Swithin. Yes, replied the clerk, as the hour struck. The fact is, sir, he is a deputy, and apt to be rather wandering in his wits as regards time and such like, which have stood in the way of the man's getting a benefit. But no doubt he'll come. The regular incumbent is away, then? He's gone for his bare passance fortnight, that's all, and we was forced to put up with a weak talented man or none. The best man goes into the brewing, or into the shipping nowadays, you see, sir. Doctrine's being rather shattery at present, and your money's worth not sure in our line. So we church officers be left poorly provided with men for odd jobs. I'll tell ye what, sir, I think I'd better run round to the gentleman's lodgings, and try to find him. Pray do, said Lady Constantine. The clerk left the church. His wife busied herself with dusting at the further end, and Swithin and Viviette were left to themselves. The imagination travels so rapidly, and a woman's forethought is so assumptive, that the clerk's departure had no sooner doomed them to inaction than it was borne in upon Lady Constantine's mind that she would not become the wife of Swithin St. Cleeve, either today or on any other day. Her divinations were continually misleading her, she knew. But a hitch at the moment of marriage surely had a meaning in it. Ah, the marriage is not to be. She said to herself. This is a fatality. It was 20 minutes past, and no parson had arrived. Swithin took her hand. If it cannot be today, it can be tomorrow, he whispered. I cannot say, she answered. Something tells me no. It was almost impossible that she could know anything of the deterrent force exercised on Swithin by his dead uncle that morning. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.